Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a special edition of the Total Rugby League Show. This week, we'll be bringing you our thoughts about the 2021 World Cup thus far, as we're joined by author and League Express contributor Richard de la Riviere and League Express editor Martin Sadler. And a big welcome back to the show. Well, Richard, Martin, a big, big thank you for joining us and welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Total Rugby League Show. A year later than planned, but a festival of rugby league is well and truly underway. Martin, first question to you. Welcome back to the show. How are you finding the World Cup thus far?
Well, it's got lots of positives and a few negatives, Ben, in my view. First of all, I mean, you can look at the World Cup from several different perspectives, I think. The first perspective, I suppose, is from an England point of view. And from an England point of view, in terms of performances, it could hardly have gone any better. You know, England set off beating Samoa 60 points to 6, which was totally unexpected. Some people had even made Samoa the favourites for that game, but we actually blasted through the Samoans. And then the other two games against France and Greece were obviously easier games. The Greek game, I think we got 90-odd points, didn't we? But the great thing for Sean Wayne is that he's not really had many injury problems. There was just Callum Watkins in the first game. So from an England point of view, it's great. From a rugby league point of view as a whole, I think the main point has been the one-sided scorelines have been actually quite disappointing. I mean, we've had 24 games so far in the men's competition, Ben, and we've got a media competition, and I've predicted every single game correctly, which tends to show that if I can predict all the games correctly, then, you know, they must be a bit too predictable, unfortunately. We've now got the women's that started yesterday and the wheelchair. So it's going to be a very crowded schedule, isn't it? But I think the one-sided scorelines and the relatively disappointing crowds, they do mean that the tournament hasn't really yet caught fire. And I think we're all hoping, and Richard, you might, I don't know if you share this view, but we're all hoping that it really catches fire this weekend with the quarterfinals.
Yeah, but there's still a reasonable possibility that the three of the quarterfinals might be a little bit one-sided as well. I think we're all hoping that Samoa and Tonga will be the one that really delivers. I mean, Fiji beat New Zealand last time, of course, but traditionally World Cup quarterfinals have tended to be a bit one-sided before a couple of them last time. So I still think New Zealand, Australia and England will probably go through reasonably comfortably. So we will be hoping that that one's close. I mean, broadly speaking, Martin, I agree with you. I mean, I've probably been more interested, will be more interested in the Women's World Cup, which I thought got off to a great start yesterday. And the Papua New Guinea-Canada game was fantastic. But yeah, I mean, look, if we end up with a brilliant couple of semi-finals and a brilliant finals, we'll probably all forget that there were some one-sided games and some not great crowds at the start of the competition. That's what World Cups are all about. But in terms of the competition itself, I mean, Tonga with Jason Taumalolo back, they really obviously give us something. And I think Samoa are a completely different proposition to what they were on the first day against us in Newcastle. I think the way that they played at the weekend as well and how strong they look on paper, I think they're going to come strong. So that weekend's game, and then whoever wins that game and presumably plays us in the semi-final, that's going to be one hell of a game.
And just to go back to the actual matches themselves, Martin, because I've enjoyed this World Cup. There's been some great moments. I mean, Greece, they've been yeah, fantastic. Jamaica have been fantastic. France, I think have improved. Ireland, it was a toss-up, wasn't it, between them and Lebanon, who went through in Group C. So there has been moments. There has been moments for the teams who haven't made it through to the quarterfinals.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously in this World Cup, Greece and Jamaica were playing in their first World Cups. And, I mean, it's fantastic for them, isn't it? You know, they get the chance to play with the big boys and so on. But I was so delighted that they did manage to score some tries. That was the important thing. I thought the, you know, the Greeks in their first game against France, actually played incredibly well. And
that try from Nick Munoz is tried the tournament, I think.
Well, it's certainly pretty near to it. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, and one of the great images of the tournament so far was all the people in that Greek, whether it was a pub, a restaurant, whatever it was, jumping up and down and cheering their team on. That was really heartening, wasn't it? You know, it was great to see that the Greeks were making a bit of an impression in Greece itself, you know, particularly when you think about what a difficult time they've had in Greece in establishing rugby league there. So, you know, great. And again, Jamaica, when Ben Jones Bishop scored the try against New Zealand in Hull and, you know, was clapped off the field at the end, you know, marvellous images. And you know, that there is a lot to applaud in that sense. But my worry is that the organisers insisted on having 16 teams split into four equal groups with no seeding of the groups. And that inevitably led to a lot of very one-sided matches. And they also went for stadiums that had to have a capacity of at least 12,000, which in the circumstances looks rather unwise. For example, you know, in 2013, there were two fabulous games at Workington when the Scots played Tonga and Italy. And I went to both of those games and they were absolutely superb, exciting, very closely fought matches. In fact, I think the Scots beat Tonga by 2 points and drew with Italy, if you remember. Each game played in front of 7,000 and odd people. And because Derwent Park isn't that big, it looked absolutely crammed full and, you know, great nights. And we've not had that sort of thing so far this time. And I think that's a great shame. I mean, for example, Featherstone, there's not been a World Cup match scheduled for anywhere in the Wakefield district, which is obviously a strong rugby league district. And Featherstone's got the best ground in the area. They could have very easily hosted one or two of the minor games, you know, that have gone elsewhere. And they'd have made it a great night with a stadium that would have probably looked almost full again. So I think the organisers did make some misjudgments. But, you know, I think there are lessons to learn. And I think possibly they learned the wrong lessons from 2013 to some degree. Again, I don't know if Richard would agree with that.
Yeah, I certainly agree with your point on those games at Workington. We've always had a lot of stadium snobbery in rugby league, haven't we? And occasionally they sort of think, no, we don't want stadiums like Workington and Featherstone. But I was at Featherstone on Thursday for the France-Brazil women's game. For that. So that was a warm-up game, so not a World Cup game. And it's just a great stadium. I just don't see why we wouldn't have a game there. Yeah, so I do agree with you on that, Martin. But just one of the obvious areas that we can hopefully look to improve going forward is to find a way of making the Northern Hemisphere teams more competitive. What's happened in the Southern Hemisphere is that all of the players who qualify for one of the previously minor nations are now playing for those countries. Obviously, Jason Tomaloa, obvious exception, but plenty of others are now happy to play for Tonga and Samoa. We've got to find a way of making sure that players who qualify for both England and, let's say, one of the other home nations actually has an incentive to go and play for Ireland, Scotland or Wales. Because I'm sure you remember in 2000, Ireland had that brilliant team with McDermott, O'Connor and Joynt and plenty of other great names played in that team. But the modern day equivalents all want to play for England. And I think maybe they need to find a way of making playing for Ireland, Scotland or Wales more attractive. They certainly need more fixtures, but possibly maybe evening up the money that players get paid. Because obviously, if the England players get the big money and Ireland, Scotland and Wales don't really get paid anything, then they're obviously all going to want to go and play for England. So if you can find a way of persuading future Alex Walmsley to play for Scotland, for example, because he does qualify for them, then that's the way of cracking that. Because if we can make Ireland, Scotland and Wales as strong as Ireland were in 2000 or as strong as Scotland were in 2013, then that will go a long way to giving us much more competitive World Cups.
When we talk about looking back at the World Cup, there has to be some form of looking at the international calendar more generally, I think. So teams like Wales, who did have a significant proportion of Welsh-born players in the squad, and France is the same, you know, getting them more matches where they can start to cut the teeth more.
Yeah, well, that's important. And but going back to Richard's point about players, you know, playing for their country of heritage, an interesting example this year, really, because Morgan Knowles has previously played for Wales, but in this tournament, he's playing for England. But the curious thing is that it looks as though he's been edged out of the loose forward position by Victor Radley, who's another guy playing for his heritage, you know. And if Morgan Knowles had played for Wales, obviously would have been a first choice, and he would have very significantly strengthened the Welsh challenge. And it might have got them over the line against the Cook Islands, for example. And they might have done a lot better against Papua New Guinea on Monday night. I mean, it's all ifs and buts, isn't it? You can't. But another guy, you know, who the Welsh were supposed to be courting was Harry Smith, the Wigan halfback, who's apparently got a grandparent who was born in Wales too. And again, if Harry had played for Wales, alongside Morgan, for example, they would have looked a much, much stronger side. So I think Richard's point about, getting heritage players on side in the Northern Hemisphere is a very important one. And that, of course, is why we are getting the strength that we're seeing in the Southern Hemisphere. And the international body, International Rugby League, said some years ago that their aim in the short term was to try and generate 8 teams that were genuinely competitive, that could be competitive in a World Cup, to give 4 great quarterfinals. That they're pretty near to having done that now. We'll see how it works out this weekend. But, it was a laudable aim. And, that the way that these South Pacific teams have recruited players has been tremendous for the strength of the game as a whole. And as Richard says, we need to see that now replicated in the Northern Hemisphere, ideally for 2025, so that there will be a stronger challenge from the home nations.
Absolutely. And Richard, just to touch upon, the one-sided natures of the groups and all that. I mean, I've been, because sometimes at night I get a bit bored and I've been watching the T20 World Cup. And there was a kind of a first round group matches, wasn't there, with some teams outside the top nations who took part in the tournament, therefore, and were knocked out before the most significant matches. Could that work, do you feel, given International Rugby League is throughout the other 3 years of the Rugby League calendar?
All right, so my cricket knowledge isn't that great, but I think what happened was they had some sort of week's worth of preliminary games, and then you ended up with the two groups. So if you were to replicate that, you would then have, say, maybe 6 teams, maybe the 6 weakest teams playing games between themselves for a week or so, or 10 days, whatever. And then you would feed the winners, the best of those teams, into groups with all the stronger teams, and then so you wouldn't get the likes of Greece up against England and Scotland up against Australia. So yeah, I think there's certainly merit to that. I think that's a good idea.
And then going back full circle, Martin, those games could take place at Featherstone and Derwent Park, maybe. Just throwing that out there.
Well, there are all sorts of things that could be done. I mean, in 2013, for example, there were 14 teams then, but the groups were split into 2 elite groups of 4 teams in each, where the 8 strongest teams in the competition competed, with 3 teams going through from each group, and then 2 lower level groups of 3 teams each, where 1 team went through from each group. And I mean, it was quite interesting that if you look back at 2013, as I think I've written in League Express, of those 6 teams in groups C and D, there were 9 games altogether between them. And the average winning margin in all those games was 6.67 points. So in other words, 9 games with the total margin of 58 points in all 9 games. Well, we're getting that in one game now, aren't we? And that's why the crowds were very good in 2013, because people turned up to those games expecting to see very close games, and that's exactly what they got. But as I said at the start, there's always more than one way to look at a situation. I mean, for looking at it, as you've said, from the point of view of a rugby league fan, the rugby's been fantastic. There have been some brilliant tries. There's been all the major stars of World Rugby League here on show in this country. You know, the whole object of this tournament was to raise rugby league status, not just to have a tournament that rugby league aficionados like us would enjoy, but which would appeal to a much wider audience. And that so far doesn't yet, to me, seem to have been achieved. You know, we need to hopefully be able to do that over the next 3 weeks, right up to the final later this month.
I mean, my kids have loved it, I have to say. So we've got one convert, and he's 4 years old.
Good.
So that's good. although he does say it's a goal when someone scored a try, which that's partly my fault, dear listener.
Badly brought up, I'm afraid.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just to touch upon the quarterfinals later this week, on Friday, we've got Australia against Lebanon at Huddersfield. On Saturday, we've got New Zealand against Fiji in Wigan. We've also got England against PNG in Hull. And on Sunday, Tonga against Samoa. Just a quick go around the virtual table. Richard, what's your thoughts, Australia-Lebanon? Can Lebanon produce an upset here in Huddersfield?
No, Well, I'll predict the four, and I'll also predict we'll all probably predict Australia, England, New Zealand reasonably comfortably. I mean, you'd think Australia will win that by 50 odd, maybe. I think England will probably win by at least 24, maybe up to 30 and more. I think New Zealand will be really out for revenge for what happened last time. I can't see a repeat of what happened 5 years ago in that one. I think New Zealand will win that quite comfortably. And then Tonga, Samoa. Well, you'd probably say Tonga, wouldn't you, with Tamalolo back? But I just think that Samoa will be out to show that what happened on that first day really wasn't them at all. So maybe that's where there'll be an upset. Maybe Samoa can produce something on Sunday at Warrington.
I mean, Matt, Samoa have been growing, haven't they, in this tournament after a shaky start up in Newcastle. So you wouldn't put it past them.
No, the thing is that we were very fortunate to play the Samoans only 2 weeks after the NRL Grand Final. And, you know, they had so many Penrith players in their side that had been obviously celebrating that incredible victory. And they just weren't ready for that first game, if we're really honest about it. And that's one reason why we scored so many points late on in the game as well. And clearly they're now out to show us what they can do, and they're out to beat Tonga on Sunday. And I think there's a very good chance that they will do. And that would then throw up a very interesting semi-final at the Emirates Stadium in London between England and Samoa. And, you know, that would be, I think, a very different game to the one that we saw in Newcastle. I still think and hope that England would win it, of course, but it would be a hell of a tougher game. And it would be interesting, you know, that game would be an interesting sell on that basis, wouldn't it? That, you know, the Samoans would be going to that game to make amends for that poor performance in the opening game. So fascinating little undercurrents of stories there. As for the other games, I mean, I agree with Richard. I think Australia will run up probably 50 points against Lebanon, unfortunately, despite Mitchell Moses playing for Lebanon and playing very well for them. And it's hard to see the Kiwis being too troubled by Fiji, given the way that Fiji have played in this tournament so far. I don't think Fiji have been as strong this time as they have been in previous tournaments. And England and Papua New Guinea, I think Papua New Guinea will give England quite a good test, actually. I've been quite impressed by the Kummels, but I don't think they'll be quite strong enough to beat England. But, you know, they've got some really fine players. And Edwin Epapi, I think, has been one of the players of the tournament so far. And he will, you know, along with the other Lee guys, Lachlan Lamb and Neil McDonald, they'll be out to show what they can do, won't they, against England. So it's certainly a game to look forward to.
This World Cup basically needs England to get through to the final, doesn't it? How likely do you think that is? Because, you know, England against PNG it's not a foregone conclusion at all. PNG have been pretty good this World Cup, haven't they? But that London game at Arsenal needs England there, doesn't it, really? But no pressure on Sean Wayne and the squad.
Yeah, look, I mean, Martin's right. Papua New Guinea are very good. And when you look down their team, the majority of their players are playing in Australia or England, whereas in previous tournaments, they've had lots of players in their own domestic league, which, whilst very, very good, obviously, they're probably better off having lots of players from Super League or you know, the NRL in their team. I think we will win that, though, and we will be in that game at Arsenal. You're right, we haven't had a home... We've not been in a home World Cup final since Super League began, so it'll be very nice to see. And it desperately does need England in that final. You're certainly right about that. 2013, of course, we say was great, but of course what let it down was that heartbreaking late defeat to the New Zealanders at Wembley, and then New Zealand weren't really competitive in the final against Australia. But let's just give a bit of credit to England. I mean, it's easy to say that it was a good time to play Samoa, but Sean, you know, he's got a lot right in this tournament. He was criticised at the start for picking some of his old guard, you know, guys like McIlorum and Williams. I always remember Mal really told me once that he had a test series against the Kiwis in 89 and they lost the first test. And then he made quite a few changes. And he said to me, he said, you've got to have guys who, you know, are mentally strong and mentally tough enough. Because sometimes when you're a national coach, you don't always know every player in the competition that intimately. And sometimes you do, as an international coach, Malcolm told me, you do depend on guys who you know and who you know have got the mental fortitude to do well in a tournament. So I always thought that was maybe his reasoning for picking guys like McIlorum and Williams. And we do see, compared to 2017, you know, when we had John Bateman in the centre, which Scobie criticised right through the tournament, didn't he? We've got genuine attack quality now out wide, spoilt for choice on the wing. our two centres just look like they can score tries from anywhere. So I think we're not just better than we've been for a long time, but I think we're easier on the eye as well. So this is an England team to get very, very excited about. And I think even if we don't end up winning the tournament, I think I'd like to think that the RFL can use that opening game against Samoa to market this team for a long time and to say, look at these superstars and look what they can do.
And that's the key, isn't it now, Martin, with England? It is about building on this. And like we touched upon earlier with what we said about Wales and France, and it's about growing that now in the Northern Hemisphere and building.
Yeah, and creating stars. You know, that most sports progress by creating star names, don't they? And players who the public want to learn more about. And we've had that, I think, in this tournament with, for example, Dominic Young has been undoubtedly the standout star in the first three games. You know, he's played outstandingly well, scored lots of tries. He's got potential star quality, speaks well as well. What a great discovery he is. You know, and there are others. You know, I think the England team comes across very, very well. When they're interviewed on TV, almost without exception, I think, you know, they do well. And I think Richard's point about Sean Wayne is an excellent one as well, because he's allowed the players, I think, to express themselves in this tournament. Admittedly, so far, not yet against the toughest opposition, but you know, we've seen a lot of creativity. We've seen some thrilling tries, and you know, I think the players, very importantly, have looked as though they've been enjoying themselves when they've been on the field. You know, and that's really important. And as Richard says, Sean was criticised for picking some of the older guys, you know, the guys like Chris Hill and Ryan Hall. But those guys have shown over time that they've got, you know, they've got the mental fortitude that's required. And, you know, it's worked well so far. And I think we're all keeping our fingers crossed that it works right up to the final. I mean, it's, what is it now, 50 years since we won a World Cup. So what a great time to win one again, you know, 50-year gap. It's far too long, but it would be a very symbolic time to end that dreadful run.
And just before we move on to the Women's World Cup and the Wheelchair World Cup, just a quick prediction, Richard. What is your final at Old Trafford in a couple of weeks' time?
England v Australia. And I'm sorry to say, I think Australia will probably just have a little bit too much rest. We're good enough to beat them if they play badly, which we weren't in 2017. But I think Australia would have to be below their best for us to, significantly below their best for us to beat them. So I would say Australia will beat us in the final.
Okay. And Martin, your final at Old Trafford?
Yeah, I think it will be England-Australia. I mean, I think Australia will beat the Kiwis in the semi-final. And I would say probably England have probably got what I would put as a 25% chance if they play Australia in the final. I think Richard's right that, you know, Australia will have to be not at their best and England will have to be spot on, really, if we're going to beat them. But it's certainly not a hopeless task. And I think it could well work. And, you know, the payoff from England winning the final would be so enormous that we've got to, obviously, the England squad has got to do everything it possibly can to achieve that result.
Well, that's the men's World Cup and the final in a couple of weeks' time at Old Trafford. But there has already been a World Cup final that took place in the PDRL. And big congratulations to England, but also congratulations to New Zealand, Wales and Australia in that tournament. That picked up good mileage, didn't it, Martin, that World Cup this past week or so?
It did. Unfortunately for us, it kicked off at 7:30 p.m. on Sunday evening, which meant it was too late to include in our League Express editions this week. But we will have a review of the game in League Express next Monday, which sadly is a week late. But it's been fantastic to see the PDRL tournament and great to see the sort of publicity that's been given to it by Adam Hills, who's such a notable player at that level of the game. And, you know, he's taken every opportunity he's had to promote PDRL Rugby League, and it was great to see England doing so well in it as well, and beating Australia fairly comfortably too. So Rugby League has spread its wings so much, hasn't it, over recent years. Certainly when we first launched League Express 30 years ago, there was the men's game and just a very few women's teams scattered around, less than a handful probably. But now, you know, the game has grown so much in that regard, and it's great to see. The only bad thing about it is that it's so difficult to keep up with everything that's going on, Ben.
And so, this goes back to what I said earlier, Richard, about it being a festival of rugby league. It really has. It's been such an ambitious tournament, and we're still only partway through it.
Well, that's right. We did actually have, though, in 2008, what was called the Festival of World Cups. So there were several World Cups then. So I don't think it's a new thing, but the standards have risen so much since then. I mean, particularly women's and wheelchairs now, you watch them and you're just so impressed. I confess to having watched very little of wheelchair rugby league up till now, but I watched the England-France International in the summer, and I was so impressed with it that it actually made up the final entry into my book, Rugby League on This Day. Because I just wanted to get it in there. I thought it was fantastic. And I think England and France it'll be between them two probably for the Wheelchair World Cup. And the women's game has just come on leaps and bounds. I think we're quite a long way behind the Southern Hemisphere. But if you just chart the improvement in the women's game over the years in England, it's just gone through the roof.
Yeah, absolutely. And Marty, just to touch upon the Women's World Cup, that obviously got underway. We're recording this show on Wednesday. Obviously got underway yesterday on Tuesday at Headingley. Got off to a flyer, I'm going to suggest, on and off the pitch on Tuesday night, the Women's World Cup.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. England getting off to a great start. But the Brazilians, I mean, the great thing about these other tournaments, the women's and the wheelchair tournaments, is that they actually draw nations that are not actually here for the men's tournament. So, you know, in the women's tournament, obviously, we've got Brazil and we've got Canada. I mean, both those nations went down in their opening games, but Canada had a great performance against PNG, and Brazil, I actually loved seeing them score a try. You know, it was a real celebration, and I think everybody at Headingley and everybody watching on television was probably equally pleased to see the Brazilians, who just looked absolutely up for it and as keen as mustard, really. And, you know, to actually have a team from South America playing in any Rugby League World Cup is just a magnificent achievement. And hopefully, the game will build on that and they'll come back next time even stronger.
And that's the thing, isn't it, Richard? I mean, this is just, it's another branch, another avenue for Rugby League to expand. I know Chile have got a decent men's team in the Americas, but, you know, here we are talking about Brazil, who've scored at a World Cup now.
Yeah, I can look back at lots of World Cups and think of players and teams that really made a mark. And for me, it'll be the Brazil women at this tournament. And I think my favourite player of this tournament is Fisher Oliveira, who I saw on Thursday at Featherstone against France in the warm-up, and then she was brilliant again yesterday. My understanding is that a couple of people from the RFL went to Brazil in about 2018 or 2019 and went to a big festival of rugby league and were so impressed with what they saw. They managed to sort of get Brazil into the tournament on the back of that.
Wow.
I think people in Fiji were a bit upset that their team hadn't been included, but you've got to draw the line somewhere. And I think on what we've seen so far, I think they probably will be competitive against Canada. I think that'll be a game worth watching. And I think PNG might have a bit too much of them in the end. So I'd expect them to go home with zero wins, but having made a real impact on the competition. And that's what you want from some of the lesser lights.
Touching upon Canada as well, Martin, they gave PNG a game, didn't they?
They did. And, you know, it's great to see. And again, the interesting thing is we've not had Canada or the United States in the men's tournament this time, but we do have Canada in the women's tournament, and we have the USA in the wheelchair tournament. So, you know, it's a great way to keep more nations involved. And we'd love to see the men's teams from those nations, you know, making a bid to, you know, get into the World Cup again. I mean, you know, there's even the potential, isn't there, for a World Cup of 20 nations, because, you know, in a strange sense, the more nations who join, the less likely you are to have so many one-sided games, because there would be more nations of a roughly equal standard with each other. So it's going to be really fascinating. You know, again, going back to the men's, the Jamaicans, what will be the effect of their participation in the men's tournament back in Jamaica? It's all to play for, isn't it, as far as I'm concerned?
Yeah, absolutely. In the women's tournament this evening, Pool B on Wednesday gets underway. New Zealand taking on France, Australia taking on the Cook Islands, a doubleheader in York. Marty, just to touch upon that England squad, I mean, I've interviewed a few of the England squad this season already, and they're already legends. They're such brilliant flag bearers for the sport.
Oh, it's a great squad. I don't think it'll be quite strong enough to beat Australia. I mean, the Australians are probably by far the favourites to win the tournament. They're now paying their players quite handsomely in the women's game in Australia, the NRLW, and they're unearthing some absolutely fabulous talent. The Kiwis, on the other hand, I mean, they're a great side as well, but I think they are missing some players because in New Zealand there are quite a few women players who play both codes of rugby, and of course at the moment the Women's World Cup in Rugby Union is taking place in New Zealand, so some of the Kiwi women have actually opted to play in that tournament rather than this one, and I think that has weakened the New Zealand women a little, you know, for the Rugby League World Cup. So it's going to be probably an interesting semi-final between England and New Zealand, and it would be great for England to get there. I think they've got a real chance of beating the Kiwis, but I think against the Australians, it would probably be a step too far for the English team. But obviously, naturally, I hope I'm wrong.
And obviously, like Marty touched upon there, with the developments of the game in Australia, which have been tremendous in recent years. What's been going on here in the Northern Hemisphere, though, has been pretty impressive. Not to the scale, obviously, but the development of the women's game has been tremendous domestically, that's for sure, in the build-up to this World Cup.
Well, that's right, yeah. It's really moved up a few notches since the Super League clubs got involved. So we've now got sort of St Helens rather than Thato Heath, for example. And the community clubs are just producing now so many girls. They've got all the age groups. They've got girls' teams. It's absolutely incredible. Lovely to see that Leeds Rhinos will be playing their women players next year. That's a big step in the right direction. I spoke to a couple of quite well-known players' agents, actually, about 6 months ago, and they insisted it wouldn't happen until a TV deal came in. But I just sort of thought, well, surely they can afford match payments, you know, even if it's on a par with the men's League One competition. I mean, surely St Helens and Wigan and Warrington and Huddersfield can afford that. And I don't know what the payments will be, but if it's on a par with your traditional win-lose bonuses in the lower ends of the male professional game, then that's surely affordable. So I hope that Leeds will be joined by all the other clubs by the time next season starts, and they'll be getting their, you know, the payments, plus also expenses that they should have had by now, I think.
The profile has just increased so enormously, hasn't it? I was at the Hall of Fame dinner last week when the Women's Rugby League Hall of Fame was inaugurated, and three women were inducted into it for the very first time. And, you know, it was absolutely incredible. And, you know, they got a wonderful reception. And, you know, I think, as Richard says, if you get a television deal, it makes paying players so much easier. And I think that by the time the World Cup ends, who knows what the profile of Women's Rugby League will be. So I think there's every chance that there will be a TV deal coming up, you know, because apart from anything else now, there are so many, there's such a diverse range of TV outlets potentially that it should be possible to negotiate a deal with someone, and you know, we'll keep our eyes very closely on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I'm biased. The hourly coverage isn't necessarily a TV deal like we touched upon here, but the coverage in our league has been pretty good, hasn't it, as well? Just to say as well, I mean, we spoke about the Heartland clubs, but a special mention for Super League South, you know, the work London Broncos are doing, and Cardiff, the Welsh team's pretty much the Cardiff team, isn't it? I mean, it's superb what's been going on there. And just to touch upon the Wheelchair Rugby League as well, that gets underway on Thursday at the Copper Box, with Spain taking on Ireland and England taking on Australia in Group A. Then we've got Group B matches with France, Scotland and Wales and America going head-to-head in that tournament. Richard, you've already touched upon it, but I think it'd be surprised if it's not an England-France final, but surprises do happen in sport.
Well, they do. What I remember of that game, I remember that the brilliant French captain, Lionel Alizar, he made a real impression on me. I thought he was a fabulous player. And England were too good for them on that day, with Seb Bacharo, who plays for Catalan Dragons, Nathan Collins at Leeds, I thought was outstanding. Coyd and Halliwell also play for Leeds. Just really, really good players. If you've never watched it, just watch it. It is so good. It really is. Wheelchair Rugby League is an absolute treat to watch. And yeah, I don't know enough about it to start making predictions. The bookies have got England and France as the favourites to get through the groups and into the final. So if that's correct, then who knows who will win the final. But just put your feet up and enjoy it, because it really is fantastic to watch.
Well, the first game is actually Spain v Ireland, but England's first game is on Thursday night against Australia at 7:30, obviously shown on live on TV. And, you know, to get the chance to see England hopefully beating Australia, hopefully convincingly, although I'd never say that about an Australian team playing any form of rugby league, but it would be great to see England beating Australia, and maybe that would give a lot of heart to the men's and women's teams as well for when they come up against the Australians. It certainly will be a fascinating game on Thursday night.
And we mentioned the growth of the domestic game in the women's version of the sport, but you know, the work that's gone on with Halifax, with Leeds, with London, with Wigan, and the Catalans as well, we should say, in France, growing the sport. It's been tremendous. And I know Wales will be an outside chance in this tournament, but the work that's gone on at North Wales Crusaders over the years. I mean, one reason why there's more eyes on Wheelchair Rugby League more than ever before is because of the TV coverage that we've been getting on our league, on Sky Sports, on the BBC. Yeah. And, you know, once you watch it, you are hooked, essentially. And how much are you looking forward to that final potentially at I was going to say the GMX. It's Manchester Central nowadays. You've always known it as Manchester Central, we should say. For me and Richard, it's the GMX. But anyway, that's by the by. How much are you looking forward to that final and the exposure the wheelchair version of the game is going to be getting over the coming
Very
week?
Much so. And I actually do hope that the final is between England and France, because I'd love to see, you know, I'm so keen to see France doing well at any level of the game, particularly when you bear in mind that they're hosting the next tournament, or tournaments, we should say. So it's going to be an incredible, it will be sold out, that game, I'm pretty sure. And it will be an incredible lead up to the men's and women's final the following day at Old Trafford. And one benefit, actually, of the tournaments having been delayed for a year is that the finals will now all be in the same city over one weekend, and I think that's going to be a real festival of rugby league for the city of Manchester, and hopefully with full houses at both venues. So I can't wait. And but as I say, I can't wait to see England playing Australia on Thursday night. I love any encounter at anything between England and Australia is always great to anticipate, isn't it? And the only problem is sometimes, from England's point of view, we don't win enough of them, whatever sport it is. But hopefully on Thursday night, that will be reversed.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. Just to mention the semi-finals in Sheffield, you know, the work that the Sheffield Eagles have done, Doncaster as well, the work that's been going on there. I mean, I could name many cities and towns with rugby league clubs who put so much work into this World Cup. It really has been fantastic. And Richard, just to mention as well, because I touched upon the TV coverage, just to mention for the BBC, they really have, they put the work into this World Cup, haven't they? They are covering every single inch of it.
Yeah, and not just that, they've got a very, very impressive team of pundits and commentators. I thought it was great that they sort of unveiled them all just before the tournament and said who they all were. I mean, the England-Brazil game yesterday, Sharon Shortley, yeah, really good commentator, and, you know, Faye Gaskin, Andrea Dobson, really, really, you know, it's just been fabulous right across the board. I always remember the 95 World Cup, they got so much criticism for only televising four matches, and that was such a disappointment. Their attitude now is just so much more where we want it, so supportive of rugby league, and it, like you say, it's just fabulous to just cover everything. Is just incredible.
It's also worth saying, Richard, that the BBC have been tremendous in covering every single game in this World Cup on one channel or another. And I actually rather doubt, if it had only been a men's tournament this year, for example, I rather doubt that every game would have been covered. I think the BBC have been so keen on this because it has been such an inclusive tournament for, you know, the three tournaments in one. And, you know, it's been shown to be such an inclusive sport in that sense. So, you know, it's really worked extremely well. And I think the BBC, you know, all credit to them. I just hope that we keep the BBC on side going forward. Just one interesting point about the BBC's coverage as well that I was a bit surprised by. Going back to the opening weekend, we had that great opening game, England-Samoa, and that got very, very respectable figures. But then we had a very one-sided game in week two between Australia and Scotland, if you remember, on the Friday night in Coventry. But the amazing thing about that was it did draw in 800,000 viewers for a BBC Two match. And apparently the surprising thing was that those viewers kept watching right to the very end. I mean, I found it difficult to watch because it was so one-sided, but apparently the viewers hung on with it. And you know, again, that's an interesting point because
maybe we
worry too much about one-sided games.
I was going to say, Martin, just to go full circle back on this, if Channel 4's coverage has shown anything, it's if it's on, people will watch it. And I'm glad, Richard, you mentioned Sharon Shortall. I had three commentators written down with all due respect to the brilliant talent already available on BBC Sport, but Sharon Shortall, Mark Wilson and Andrew Voss as well. Just a special mention from the Australian Judith Chalmers, who's been so, brilliant stuff. Going to several restaurants that I've actually been to. And I mean, you know, Sharon Shortall, Mark Wilson, Andrew Voss, and the existing commentary team, they've all done a superb job, haven't they, Richard, covering this World Cup thus far?
Oh, they have. There's no doubt about it. I mean, down the years, the BBC would get criticism for their commentators, but they've got, as you say now, quite a few, all doing a really good job. A bit worried about Vossi's diet, though. I mean,
oh, what? Some of those kebabs, mate. Can't have them every day of the week.
Is he going to get back in his aeroplane seat okay? But anyway, he's on holiday, so...
He'll be okay. I just wish that everybody in the NRL and on Australian TV was as enthusiastic about international rugby league as Vossi is, because then there would be no problems, would there? Everybody would be pulling forward together and... you know, he's such an enthusiast. It's quite incredible, really. Not just for the rugby league, and not just for the World Cup, but also for England. Actually, he's a great Anglophile, clearly. And you know, if he likes English food that much, he really must be, mustn't he?
Yeah, that's
well. If Phil Gould was this enthusiastic about English rugby league and international rugby league, the World Cup would have probably happened last year.
You know, maybe all he was missing was a Wigan kebab. Maybe that's all he was missing. But anyway, just to finish things up, it's been good catching up, Martin and Richard, on this special show, partway through the World Cup. But Richard, we've covered off, I think, all angles there. A couple of cities I've not mentioned, you know, York with their development of the women's game and Newcastle. What a whole city for the opening game and the work that's been going on there as well. I could name loads of places, couldn't I, with what's been going on. But just a closing thought, Richard, just before we leave. Generally, despite, you know, some of the misgivings, I think it's been all right. I think it's been all right. And here's to three England victories over the next fortnight.
Fingers crossed, yeah. Yeah, I'd love the World Cup every 2 years. I really would, because I don't think any other international competition is really cutting the mustard now. So it's so good, and you just get so gripped by World Cup, so much more than anything else, and certainly more than the domestic game. I just want them to be as often as possible. And if we had them every 2 years, I think that would be a step in the right direction for the international game and the game as a whole.
And building upon that, maybe with that kind of mini qualification tournament as well, that might be a goer for a regular international competition of a significant status, maybe.
Oh, there are all sorts of potential structures that would work and might perhaps work better than we've got at the moment. So, you know, no doubt a lot of those will be considered. But it's worth bearing in mind that we're already seeing the qualification games being set up for the next World Cup finals in France in 2025. There's quite a wide-ranging, I don't quite know how many European countries have entered, but, you know, there will be quite a lot, and it's going to gradually work through, and, you know, we'll see what happens there. But I think we're all looking forward to the rest of the tournament, and what a great few weeks of rugby league to look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we've seen what happens when a team gets to this World Cup, who rugby league was banned in their country. We've seen how much Greece have enjoyed it and what impact that's had. And you know, is to countries like, you remember back in the qualification for this tournament, Norway and Spain, you know, the rugby league countries like that, and what an impact just the qualification
Absolutely.
Round had on those teams was sensational, yeah. wasn't it? Richard, just before you go, just a quick plug for Rugby League Heroes and Rugby League Express next week. What's coming up over the coming days and weeks?
Thanks very much. So I think the current interview is with Alan Smith, and then I think the next one will be with Gordon Tallis.
And Marty, just a plug for Rugby League Express as well for reading that interview next week.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And don't forget Richard's book that's out on this day. Richard didn't mention that. Great book. Look at the history of rugby league in a quite unique way. But yes, we've got Gary Schofield writing about the tournament, Jamie Peacock writing about it. I'm writing about it, of course. And Richard's incredibly popular series of Rugby League Heroes articles. As he says, currently it's Alan Smith, a great interview with Alan Smith, the great former Leeds and Great Britain player. And next Monday, the beginning of a two-parter, in fact, with the great Gordon Tallis. So a terrific amount to look forward to, I think.
Richard, you did drop that hint of a new book out, and I didn't take the bait, did I? I do apologise. Go on, sell the book properly.
Okay, well, I've written a book called Rugby League on this day, so it's 366 different stories, one for each day of the year, obviously, so if you include February the 29th, it's 366 different dates. So the story range from the 1800s right the way through to that wheelchair match this summer in 2022. I've tried to cover as much as I can. I've got quirky stuff, I've got some funny stories, and I've got all the great moments, the great cup finals, the great internationals. It's a book. It's available on eBay. Just type in Rugby League on this day, £12, including postage, for 366 Rugby League stories. The perfect stocking filler, I think.
Great stuff. Well, Martin, Richard, a big, big thank you for joining us on this special show this week. TotalRL.com, the place to go to for all the news and interviews and discussing everything with regards to Rugby League. But we're going to go now. A big thanks for joining us this week, and you'll be hearing from us again very soon. Bye-bye.